Hello and welcome to the Whiteboard Rugby podcast, and this is a blindside edition, but we are joined by a voice and face, if you're watching this, who will be familiar to you from a couple of weeks ago, Charlie Beckett. Charlie, thank you very much for coming back.
Nope, not a problem, Sam. Thank you for having me back.
Well, we're going to be quizzing you today on your career. You recently retired as well. You started coaching at Loughborough Lightning with the women. We're going to talk about that kind of transition. We got some questions in from listeners as well, which we're gonna fire your way. This is basically going to be half an hour FAQ style, talking to you about life as a player, trying to get some of the insight and inside track on what that's like. I guess first question:
arguing you signed for seven different clubs all around the world that you weren't a journeyman, you can't argue that. It was never what I dreamed of. That was never the plan. The plan was to always just play at one club, but that ended quite quickly, unfortunately. I also think it comes with a negative connotation, journeyman, yeah, which I do understand. And there are disappointments in my playing career of what I didn't achieve. I am not disappointed that I played for so many clubs. I would have loved to have a long stint at one club. I would love to have played over 100 games for one club. The most I played was I did 56 for Amptill. But I think... There were some clubs that I left because I wasn't offered to be re-signed, which obviously is tough. Those other clubs I left because it was the right time for me to leave. So I definitely could have ended up staying. For example, at Amptill, I believe I was club captain. I think I could have stayed and played over 100 games for Amptill. I could still be playing there now if that is what I'd wanted to do. But for multiple reasons, I chose that wasn't what I wanted. I wanted a new adventure of going to Australia. I had an amazing time over there. So while it definitely is a fair assessment, and while there are negative connotations to it, if I hadn't played at as many clubs I had, if I hadn't played around the world like I did, there's so many amazing experiences I wouldn't have had. So I would say, yes, that is a fair assessment. And I have to come to terms with my own mind of it isn't quite as negative as it sounds all the time when people do refer to me as that. But I can't argue that I'm not. I was signed for seven clubs. You can't be like, no, I was a club stalwart at all seven. That's not how it works.
It's an interesting one because obviously it's one of those questions where you feel like, I think it's from a fan perspective, and maybe not all fans will see it this way, but I find that kind of journey perhaps more interesting than someone who went to one club, was clearly, you know, they just wanted to keep him around forever and ever and ever, and then retired at that club. I can imagine, however, that it's difficult when you're in the environment where you're playing week in, week out with some of the players who perhaps did have that kind of acclaim and that kind of backstory, that it feels perhaps more negative than to an outsider who's never even got close to playing at a professional level, who would see your career as the kind of the pinnacle.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have this conversation with my better half quite often of, I have... and I still deal on a day-to-day basis, huge disappointment with my playing career and what I didn't achieve. I spoke about when I retired of, there were so many dreams I didn't fulfill because of things I wanted to do, but for whatever reason. But she kind of says to me, but the career you had, so many people would kill to have. Like, you were a professional player for 12 years. You got paid to play rugby. How you funded your life, how you put food on the table, how you pay our mortgages, playing rugby. Like, there are so many people who would absolutely kill for that. And I do have to remind myself that sometimes, but I think how I struggle with that is that was never what I dreamt of. Like, I always dreamt of being a professional rugby player, but it wasn't like, I just want to be able to pay my bills and pay my mortgage and that's what I want. What I dreamt of growing up was, I want the hundreds of premiership appearances. I want to play for England. I want to play for the Lions. Like, these things that didn't happen, but obviously the chance of them happening are tiny. But it's almost like it would have been potentially, in my mind, easier if I just completely not made it. If I'd never made it to the Premiership Club, if I'd never been... It almost feels like you get so close and then missing it by a millimeter is the same as missing it by a mile. I still didn't achieve those things. So I loved my rugby career, my playing career. My rugby career still going. I'm coaching on my playing career. I have to get used to referring to it as my playing career and coaching career. I loved my playing career. I had an amazing 12 years. I met so many amazing people, and I enjoyed every second of it. I said in my retirement post, I'm not sure anyone's ever loved their career more than I did and enjoyed being in it. I just have to wrestle in my mind a lot of the time of the fact that I didn't achieve a lot of things I wanted to, but that doesn't mean the whole thing was a failure.
Yeah, and we might come back to that, but to switch a bit more positivity perhaps, can you talk us through your early career? When did you first start playing rugby? What inspired you? Kind of those early successes, I guess.
So as cliche as it sounds, I couldn't be more from a rugby family if I tried. Like, not at all. So my granddad was president of Waterloo Rugby Club, our local rugby club. My grandma worked in the kitchen there with him. Obviously not him, he wasn't working in the kitchen. She worked there because of that. My mum was working behind the bar when she met my dad, who was a player, or met through that. So I don't know if she was working behind the bar, but they met at the rugby club at Waterloo. I then was born into just this rugby family. My earliest memories are watching dad play at Waterloo. It's all I ever wanted to do. So I started, like, there are pictures of me with a rugby ball before I could walk. Like, we are just, rugby is in our blood, literally. We're a rugby family. So even though we're from Liverpool, which couldn't be more of a football city if it tried. So I then started at Waterloo in the mini juniors. I was 5, played there right until the age of 16. I played at school at Merchant Taylors. Head of rugby was Mike Slemon, former British and Irish Lion. Obviously, Ben Kay's old school. Ian Mackay was a rugby coach there, former Scotland second row. So really good rugby pedigree at school. And yeah, just obviously was big. That helped. Like, being physically big when you're younger, you lend yourself to rugby. I was the big kid at school. So yeah, I just have always, for as long as I can remember, rugby has been this enormous part of my life and all I've ever wanted to do. Literally, I can't remember, like, you know, when you're younger, kids always want to be a fireman or an astronaut or a doctor, and it changes all the time. Mine was always, I want to be a rugby player. I think at one point I wanted to be a rugby player who volunteered as a lifeboatman as well at some point. I think I wanted to be that when I was at 7, and then quickly got rid of that or else I'm not a gifted swimmer in the slightest. To say I can swim is a push, but all I've ever wanted to be was a rugby player, and then was very fortunate. I did well through school. I was playing Lancashire, North of England, played England under 16s. And then, off the back of it, got signed at 16 to Leicester Tigers Academy. And it just went from there.
It's an interesting one, because I was thinking about this the other day, that I played at, I wasn't very good as a kid, but I played at a good club in Yorkshire. We were Yorkshire Cup champions kind of 3 years on the day or so. And we had two guys in that team who were unbelievable, like, miles better than everyone else in the team, and more or less miles better than everyone else who we played on in the Yorkshire Cup games. And I think one of them ended up playing at that team in the north, in the Dales, with the Wharfdale. One of them played at Wharfdale for a season or two, and one of them was in an academy, maybe with Leeds, and then kind of packed it in. So neither of them really got particularly close to professional rugby. I always find it unbelievable to imagine how good you must have been, or players who end up playing at the professional level at that young age, because knowing how good those guys were and they didn't make it. Like, what was that experience like, being the absolute best at that young age?
So I actually think I was very fortunate in the fact that, and I don't think you were really meant to do this, but I played at club with lads 2 years older than me. So when I started at 5, I was playing with the under sevens. I just stayed there. So actually, when they were 12, I was 10. When they were 14, I was 12. So physically, I wasn't the biggest. So I think that helped me a lot with, I had to be good. So I had to have good technique and contact. So I was like, 12 and 10 are big differences puberty-wise. Like, I just wasn't as strong as these lads. Skills-wise, I had to, because I think that helped me massively. Because I think you see a lot of times the big lad, so to speak, doesn't have the best skills because he doesn't have to. So when I did come down to play my own age group, which I would do at school, and then as we got older, I had to come down because I think it was insurance reasons. I think someone realised that we were doing this and you're not meant to. I feel like I still carried that hopefully better technique and sort of things across. So I never really thought of myself as being like loads better, because I was lucky. I played with a lot of good players when I was younger as well. But definitely there were days where you'd score 5 tries in a game, and just because you were bigger. So yeah. I think I was fortunate that I played with older lads, which meant I wasn't the best. And I had family who definitely were very good at keeping me grounded, to say the least. But yeah, it's interesting. You do see, and I think kids can be scuppered slightly by being told you're so great all the time. You're brilliant, because there's always a step up where you become less brilliant. So you've got to be prepared when you aren't the best, because you can't be the best at every. Very few people can be the best at every step they go. Only the absolute best of the best can.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you went to Leicester, what was that experience like? Was that a kind of a, oh my God, this is now the level that I need to achieve? Or was that a kind of a, oh, actually, this is okay. I feel pretty good.
It was humbling. So you went in as a 16-year-old and you were training with the rest of the academy, which went all the way up to 19. So some of these guys had been in full-time environment for 3 years and you just chucked in with them. Remember, first session, you're into CV games and skills with these guys, and they expect you to be at their level. And the Leicester Academy at that point was a rather brutal environment, so to speak. This was 12 years ago, and it was sink or swim. And if you didn't swim, you sank very, very quickly, and there wasn't much forgiveness for the fact you were sinking. So it was humbling, but I do say those Leicester Academy days were the best days of my life. I had the best fun. I was 16 years old. I was going to college. I still did my A-levels, but I was a full-time rugby player with my best mates. And they are still the tightest group of players I know. So, for example, now I'm sat in the home office of Dave Williams, who plays on the wing for Nottingham, because I obviously very quickly moved into, I'm sure we'll get into it, coaching Loughborough. Loughborough is not particularly near Cheltenham, where I live. So 3 days a week. So I just picked up the phone to Dave. I know he lives nearby. 3 days a week, I stay at his. And that group of players, there's not much we won't do for each other, because we went through that shared hardship of the academy. And I loved the academy. There are plenty of stories I could tell that make my mum especially wince of how did I let my 16-year-old son go and do this. But I absolutely loved it. And I do credit, after my family, I credit the Leicester Tigers Academy with installing some of the things that I think are the best things about me as a man, not just a player, as a man. The academy put those things in me.
At what point did you realise, or was it told to you, that you weren't going to become a 100-cap kind of Leicester Tigers player? Was that something that was on the cards that you kind of were thinking, I'm a bit behind here, or was that just something that came out of the blue?
So this is a story not many people know, I don't think. So I was academy captain. I'd played for the first team at 18 years old. I had captained the first team in pre-season. Everything was going to plan. And then I went away to the Junior World Cup with England. I came back, was straight into pre-season with the first team. I was on in something called development group. So it was between the academy and the first team. And played at number 8 for the first team in a pre-season game against Sale. Got man of the match, player of the match, players player of the match. Had a really good game. And it was an Aaron Major just coming as head coach at Leicester. And the Monday after that game, Mage and Cockers, Richard Cockerell, said, can we have a meet with you in our office, please? And I walked in being like, here we go. I'm being offered a new contract. I'm moving up from development group to first team. This is it. And that I was asked to move up from development to first team. But it was pitched to me that I wasn't going to be quick enough to play back row for Leicester Tigers with the way Mage wanted to play. He wanted to move away from the stereotypical Leicester blindside. So I was playing 8 or 6, the Martin Corrie sort of design of this world. I was only 6'4", so wasn't going to be tall enough playing the second row. But they thought I could be a world-class tight head prop. And we had Dan Cole there who would help me. We had Tom Youngs who'd gone from centre to hooker. It was the perfect place and time to do it. They said, go away and have a think of the next week or so. But it was basically said to me that if you want to play for Leicester Tigers, this is the way you need to go. I wanted to play for Leicester Tigers, so I did. So I, for one season, was a tighter prop. I went on loan to Leicester Lions in National 2, and I had some grim days down there. Not because of Leicester Lions or National 2, just because I was a young tighter prop in the National Leagues who'd been playing 3 months. But there were some good days and some bad days. There's some really bad days, some really good days. It was going fine. It was going to plan. It was getting better. There were conversations. I was going to go to Australia to play for the summer. And there was conversations for me to go to Nottingham the season after and play in the champ, which would have been a huge step up. But it's what they did with Tom Youngs. And that was the plan. But when I agreed, the one thing we agreed on was this wouldn't be used as a reason to drop my contract or drop my money the year after, which when it came to contract time is exactly what happened. They sat down and said, we're not sure how this is going. This is the best we can offer you, which was less than I was on the year before. And I don't do lying. I don't like being lied to. I don't appreciate being lied to. So I just said, that's not what we agreed. If this is genuinely the best you can do, I'm going to leave this office and make a call. I'll be looking to leave. And they just said, yeah, that is the best we can do, which kind of showed me they weren't as all in on me and didn't think this tighter prop stuff was going as well as maybe it had been suggested it might be. So that was when I left and I made the call to Neil McCarthy, who'd been my academy manager at Leicester. He was now the academy manager at Gloucester, and I was still young enough to go in the senior academy. And I rang Macca and I said, hypothetically, if I was leaving, would you be interested? And he said, yes, but not as a tighter prop. If I thought you were a tighter prop, I would have signed, I would have moved you when you were 16. So that is how I ended up at Gloucester and ended up in the second row.
So I almost, I heard similar stories to that, not quite as extreme, but I almost ended up getting frustrated on your behalf there. I was actually chatting to my dad about this the other day, but talking more about work and how people appreciate loyalty and they appreciate kind of you sticking around and all that kind of stuff. But clubs and workplaces will be the first to kind of stab you in the back if it is beneficial to them. Do you think that kind of loyalty in rugby and kind of the fans wanting players to stick around, do you think maybe they don't quite understand what's going on behind the scenes and that stuff like this can happen a lot?
Yeah, potentially, I think. And unfortunately, being in the game for 12 years probably makes you sceptical to it a little bit. But I do think I'm a firm believer now that as long as you don't leave the club in a terrible situation, you don't lie yourself, you do have to look after yourself as a player because, like I said, the clubs, it's a business. They run it as a business, and this is how guys feed their families. This is how they pay their mortgage. So you do have to look after yourself. But mate, I'm a big believer, like, honesty solves a lot of things. If we were all just honest with each other, I know there's negotiating tactics, but I don't do lying. So I've always been honest when I've spoken to clubs, and now as a coach, I'm always honest to the players I coach. I can't say I've always been afforded the same as a player, but I know how that made me feel as a player. So I absolutely don't intend to ever be that coach who isn't honest, because I don't think that's a good way to be.
And when you left Gloucester, so you then started, you know, you were in the Championship and obviously you moved to Australia kind of later in your career. What was that experience like when you first went to the Championship? How long were you ambitious that you could jump back to the Premiership or perhaps, you know, move to France or to the USC or wherever it might be?
So I was probably naive when I left Gloucester the first time round. So I did 2 years at Gloucester after Leicester and then left to go to Jersey. I was naive to how good the Championship was. Probably presumed that I'd go into a Championship and be a starting player straight away, and that didn't happen. I was on the bench at starting Jersey because there's a lot of good players down there. I had full ambition my time in Jersey to go back to the Premiership. COVID then happened as I went out of contract to Jersey, because I chose to leave Jersey because I didn't enjoy living in Jersey, the island. It's a beautiful place, but not being on the mainland wasn't the life for me. Yeah. So I went out of contract during COVID, which it's far from the ideal time to get out of contract. But stayed fit, stayed training, got the call from Gloucester that they had a bit of a second row crisis. Went in when Skivs went in, had a 2-week trial. Signed on a 3-month deal there, played in the Premiership. My 2 Premiership games were Saracens away and Exeter away. So there you go, Charles. Baptism of fire for you. Against Chiefs away, we sent essentially our bomb squad on a Wednesday evening. They played their absolute best side. 14 of that 15 started the European final they won that year. And we had a great day. We only lost by 10 points. I played one of my best games in my career. It was in the second row against Johnny Gray and Johnny Hill. held my own and was like, yeah, I belong at this level. Like, I'm good enough for this. It was a real big moment for me. Next day, off the back of that, got offered a 2-year deal at Gloucester, which I just accepted. Like, didn't negotiate. Was like, yep, accept that. I'm happy to accept that. They said, sweet, we'll send it over to your agent. In the midst of all this, myself and my partner bought our house in Cheltenham, which is why I still live there. So was waiting for this contract to come over. After about a week, thought, this is a bit strange that it hasn't come over yet. Skivs then called me into his office a few days later, and I thought, well, this isn't good. It was the exact set. I walked in there and I said, ah, last time I was in this room with the head coach, it was David Humphreys and Johan Ackerman telling me that I wasn't going to be re-signed by Gloucester. And Skivs kind of just looked at me like, oh, and I said, ah, that's the conversation we're having, isn't it? And essentially they'd decided to put their money elsewhere. They said that they needed to sign front row. They didn't need another second row. So while they would love to keep me, they didn't need another one, which I understood. It was obviously really rubbish timing and a real shame. So I said, okay, that's fine. The disappointing thing off the back of that is 4 weeks later, they signed another second row. That stung a little bit, to say the least. But that was when I signed for Amptill, because I was like, right, well, I best earn some money. And Amptill had shown some interest beforehand, before I went to Gloucester. So I rang Dave Ward at Amptill, spoke to Mark Lavery, signed there. And I was adamant that was just going to be for the 10-game COVID season. I was going to go back to full-time as soon as I got the chance. But I loved it at Amptill. And financially, it worked more for me to be doing that than the only full-time offers I got again were from Championship clubs, and it didn't work for me to move us to go and play full time. It was Donny at the time or Pirates, when I could stay in Cheltenham, I could commute, I could do Amptill for similar financial reward. And I loved it at Amptill. I had 3 great seasons there. Proud of what we achieved, like really cementing Amptill as a Championship club. It was only their second season of Championship when I joined, so we really cemented them. Helped a lot of good young players like Theo Dan, Ollie Stonham, these guys really kick on there with the Saracens connection. But at the end of 3 years there, it was time for a change, and this Australia option came up, and just had the most incredible 4 months in Australia. And still at that point, I had aspirations to come back to the Premiership, was messaging, this is only a year ago, this is literally this time last year, was messaging all the Premiership DORs that I knew, my agent was doing it, and it just the opportunity wasn't coming. Came back and went to some injury cover at Ealing, which was great. Was at Ealing for 4 months, didn't play because they had other players. I was just there for injury cover, but that was great. Then got to January and was like, right, well, I really need to play. And Ealing didn't need me anymore because everyone was fit. So I signed for Doncaster, which is when I got playing again, and was probably when I realised I'm not enjoying playing in the Championship anymore. I've done this for a long time. I've played over 100 Championship games. I'm not enjoying this. Was working really hard, as you and I have spoken about before, to get to France. But the whole world is trying to get to France at the moment.
Yes, when
one of the clubs you're talking to then signs Courtney Laws, it's kind of like, I think the ballpark has changed here slightly of who they're looking for. So as soon as France wasn't an option, the only options in France would have been part-time. There was no point going to France, move to France to play part-time rugby. As soon as that wasn't working, and I had options to go back to Australia, but it wouldn't work for my personal life, my partner, and what we want in our personal lives moving forward. The only option was to keep playing Championship rugby, and that didn't really appeal to me anymore. But I just love coaching, and the plan was never for me to go into coaching. It was to go into a quote-unquote proper job. But I just love it. I love rugby. So I started putting feelers out about coaching, as I said, I was going to retire, and I did proper job interviews for the first time in my life. I was doing actual job interviews and this, and then very fortunately was offered the defence coach and assistant forwards coach role at Loughborough Lightning, and I'm absolutely loving it. And that is a whirlwind tour through my career, I realise, but I don't think the listeners want to hear in depth of everything because we'll be here for 12 hours.
Yeah, that was great. Well, one of the questions we got actually from Will Hooley, who did you ever play against Will?
Yeah, I think I did when he was at Bedford. I think I did while Will was at Bedford, yes.
So he's obviously in the US now. He's played for the US. He's asking how are you finding the transition? And do you think it'll only be when the season starts that you fully realise kind of, you know, that you've made the shift?
I'm finding the transition easy at the moment, but that is, I think, because I haven't really transitioned out of rugby. Like, I still go to a full-time rugby environment every day. I'm just on the other side of the fence. So I think if I wasn't in rugby, it'd be really, really hard. But at the moment, I'm not missing playing. That I tell you the only bit I do miss, when they're live mauling, genuinely with units, I could do with doing... I reckon if I could live maul once a month, I'd be a happier man. I miss that. But no, I'm loving it. Like, I couldn't be happier with coaching. And I think the fact that I haven't missed playing at any point so far shows that it really was the right time for me to transition into coaching, because, yeah, I can't say I've woken up any morning so far. I'm like, I wish I was playing still. Now, like Will says, when the season starts, that could be different, because no one enjoys preseason. Preseason's awful. When I see the boys I've played with playing and having good wins and those sort of things, I could see myself missing it more then. But right now, I couldn't be happy with the decision I made.
It's an interesting one, because obviously having myself play at grassroots level only, one of the things that I think I miss, you know, I'm kind of inging out of playing, but I think I miss rugby, apart from the contact and the big hitting and all that kind of stuff. That must be different for you. Is that something that you're missing, or is it something you think, oh, I quite like waking up on a Sunday and not being broken?
Yeah, so I don't miss waking up on a Sunday with everything hurting. I do miss hitting people. I can't lie. Like, it was my favorite bit of rugby. And that's what I have to work out, how I get that. How do I appease that side of me? Because I think anyone who plays in the front five, there has to be a side of you that enjoys pain and enjoys confrontation. I think anyone who has seen me play, saw me play, knows that confrontation wasn't anything that I would shy away from, so to speak. So how do I appease that side of me? I don't know. So far, it hasn't needed appeasement. It's been fine. But I think as the season goes on, that'll be interesting, is how do I... That and the competitive... I think the competitiveness is okay, because I'm competing every week as a coach now. I'm competing against... So I'm defence coach. I'm literally competing against the attack coach from my opposition every week. Who's going to come out on top? Is your attacker, is my defence? So I think that side of things will be fine. It's that confrontation and physicality side. I've got to work out where I get that in my life.
Well, I've got some quick fire ones from usual co-host Sam Roberts. He's asking, what's the thing you're working on most as a coach right now?
I think my delivery. I get very passionate, and I think sometimes my delivery of things can be hurt by how passionate I get. I can get too amped up. I can get too emotionally involved, and sometimes the detail can get lost. That's something I'm learning. And also the technical side. I am not a computer man. So learning properly to use, this is your world, Sam, use sports code and clipping and put together presentations. That has been a steep learning curve for me, because it is not something I'm naturally blessed with.
Yes, it feels like that might be the only bit where I might have a head start on you in a rugby career there, Charlie. His other second question is, where is the women's game better than the men's, and where does it most need to improve?
I would say it's better with fan engagement. I think you see the female players after a game are so great at just going and engaging with the fans, spending time with the fans. I know it's harder because there's more fans at men's games. I do understand that. But the women's game are brilliant with the fan engagement. I also think the style of rugby is better. It's a more enjoyable watch. I get this bit all the time. Kick battles are fascinating. Kick battles are absolutely fascinating, but they are not the most exciting to watch. I do understand that. There are less of them in the women's game. It's a faster, more free-flowing game. Where does it need to improve? I think it's getting better about how we present the women's game. The way you present things is so important. If you present it as something that people should watch, then they will watch it. I truly believe that. It's the same with the championship that we spoke about on the previous podcast a few weeks ago. If you present it in the correct way, people will watch it. So I think it needs to improve in how it's presented, both on telly, on social media, how the club present, I think, can, not that it's bad, but can continue to improve, I think.
And then his last question, what's one thing about Sarah Beckett, of course, your sister, who is an England capped player, that very few other people know?
Oh, great question. She is terrified of reptiles. Like, I'll send her reels of alligators on Instagram and she cries. Like, with that, like, I got her for her birthday. For her birthday last year, I was very proud of myself. I adopted her a crocodile at Crocodiles of the World and got her a feeding experience, and she didn't go. Like, she did not go. So yeah, she is. If you are playing against her, I'm going to tell my girls all this year to just like start whispering like crocodile or iguana in her ear to put her off a game.
That's fantastic. I'm kind of wavered on that. I'm not too bothered about alligators, but snakes I absolutely am terrified of. So anything clips of snakes, that's horrific to me.
We're going to end just with some quick fire ones, Charlie. So what is the one stadium or the stadium you were kind of the best stadium you ever played at?
There's a few. Welford Road and King's Home are brilliant. Yeah. I played as a kid at Twickenham, which is really cool. But I actually played at, when I was 17, I was lucky enough to go for 3 months to a school in Dunedin and we played at Forsyth Bar Stadium.
Oh, wow.
And that was awesome. Forsyth Bar is a really, really cool stadium.
Best player you've played with or against?
Oh, Tom Croft.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Tom Croft, nice. just incredible. Yeah, Tom Croft. Yeah.
And one club that you maybe got close to signing or were talking to that you wished you'd have gone and played at?
When I left Gloucester, I was basically dealed. When I moved to Jersey, I was dealed done basically to go to London Irish, who had just dropped the Championship then. Right. We'd agreed. Nick Kennedy had been trying to sign me. It was happening. And literally, we were beyond dotting I's and crossing T's. And Kendo said to my agent, I'll ring Charlie direct to let him know it's done when it's done. And then that was on the Monday. On the Tuesday, my phone rang from Nick Kennedy. I thought, well, I know what this call is going to be. It's going to be Kendo telling me it's done. And Kendo told me he'd been fired. That was what that call was. He'd been fired by London Irish. And none of his recruitment was happening, so I wouldn't be signing for London Irish. So that was the one that I got incredibly close to and I wish had happened.
Well, that feels bad that we ain't going out of there, Charlie. But
it's one of those. It happens. Loads of people have stories like that. Things fall through at the last minute for multiple reasons. That one was just, it was a shame. And I wish at that point, I wish I'd tried to go to France then. If I could do something different, I would have tried to go to France as a 22-year-old leaving the Premiership. Because I think if I could have got to Pro D2 then, I always think my style of play would have gone well in Pro D2. I think I could have done really well playing in Pro D2. But in my mind then, it was just you have to play in England. And I wish if I could go and tell 22-year-old me something different, it would be tell your agent to try and get you to France then rather than the Championship. Because I think that would have taken my career in a different way.
Yeah, that would have been a pretty awesome experience, I think. I think there's a lot of players retiring who've wished at one point they've made the trip over to France.
Yeah.
Well, Charlie, I really appreciate it. Obviously, we covered so much stuff there. We covered some difficult topics and some really awesome memories, I'm sure. So thank you so much for joining us on the Blindside Edition. And I think for now, this marks the end of your substitution stint until either me or Sam go off on holiday again.
Yeah, blood bin reversal. Robert's back in next week.